Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program, the legal fraternity is under siege. 13 lawyers murdered in 2 years as fears of targeted assassinations grow. The European Union doubles down on green financing with 12 billion euro for South Africa. Over 13 million South Africans rejected for credit every quarter, and universities urged to become job creation hubs as graduate unemployment rises. It's Tuesday, the 21st of October. Now, a chilling warning from the legal sector here in South Africa. In just 2 years, at least 13 lawyers have been murdered. And this is prompting rising fears of targeted assassinations among the profession. Now, the Law Society of South Africa says legal practitioners are increasingly facing threats to their lives simply for doing their jobs. So what is behind this shocking trend? I want to go in a little deeper. I'm in conversation with the Society's Vice President, Machini Motlong. Machini, a very warm welcome. Does your profession feel under real siege right now?
Thanks, Jeremy. It is. You know, that is the correct summation of how we feel about the current situation. The legal profession is indeed currently facing a grave threat. And this, over the past year, we've seen a disturbing increase in assassinations and targeted attacks against attorneys, advocates, even members of the prosecution. That is really a cause for concern.
Is it too early to say that it's an organized campaign, or are they simply a series of tragic, isolated incidents?
Look, where we are of the view that this is an attack to the rule of law, and it cannot just be isolated or, you know, sporadic type of attack, but it is more organized in our view. It is a concerted and organized a crime that is being waged against legal professionals in the country.
How do you think the threat then is changing the way in which lawyers are working day to day?
Look, obviously this would inevitably send shockwaves to the legal fraternity, and to a certain extent the legal professionals would be forced to withdraw from sensitive and high-profile cases. So these threats, by character and nature, poses a real challenge to lawyers. It also discourages young people from pursuing careers in law, which could have a long-term detrimental effect on their profession's ability to serve the society. So it's something that really we are of the view that it will undermine the public access to justice, and it will erode the trust in the legal system.
And that's the real problem, isn't it? Because there is huge consequence if lawyers are simply too afraid to handle high-profile cases.
Indeed, because that goes to the heart, as I say, because the cornerstone of democracy rests on the rule of law. And there's also the provision in our constitution, particularly section 34, 35, which guarantees the right to a person who appears in courts to be represented by a legal practitioner. Now, if legal practitioners are so afraid to render legal services to everyone, fearing for their safety and for their lives, that poses a serious threat to our democracy and to our rule of law.
So what advice then is the Law Society giving to your members, and are there protection systems that either exist for lawyers or are being improved, and are they working?
Look, we just have to be intentional in terms of condemning this spate of attacks and assassinations on the broader legal fraternity or legal professionals. But we should also ensure the safety of our members and make this our top priority. We need to advocate for a multi-pronged approach, you know, such as risk assessments. We need to ensure that we conduct regular risk or security risk analysis for lawyers who are involved in high profile or contentious cases, but also about physical security. We need to be intentional in implementing protective measures such as a secure office space, panic buttons, and when necessary, personal protection for those at the heightened risk. But training is also important, Jeremy. We need to provide safety and situational awareness training to all legal professionals. But we cannot work in silos. We need to ensure that we collaborate. And collaboration is important in this instance. We need to strengthen cooperation with law enforcement to create rapid response protocols in the event of threats or attacks. But where does it stop? I think it will stop where if there is deterrent. And where can we look at the deterrents? I think there should be legislative action. We need to lobby for stricter penalties for crimes against legal professionals and ensure that investigations involved in crimes that were committed against legal professionals are prioritized. These are very many other, you know, interventions that we are of the view that should they be considered, it will go a long way in safeguarding the interest of legal professionals, ensure that they operate within a safe space.
I want to circle back quickly to collaboration. Do you think that law enforcement and intelligence agencies in that respect are taking this current threat seriously enough? After all, it's been ongoing and being amplified over the past 2 years.
Look, I think the more has to be done, Jeremy. We need to also urge the public to support efforts to bring perpetrators to justice. And the authorities should act decisively. Currently, even if it means that we should gravitate towards considering having a task team, that a police task team that should look into the killings of legal professionals. More has to be done to ensure that those collaborative efforts bear fruit. It would not really create any, or it would not be helpful to us if we operate in silos, if, you know, we are poles apart in terms of how we can tackle this situation.
Well, whichever way you look at it, it is a very serious and troubling situation. From the Law Society of South Africa, I've been in conversation with Vice President Machini Motlong. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Europe, you might have read, has unveiled a massive 12 billion euro investment package to help South Africa accelerate its green transition. It's all aimed at funding energy infrastructure and sustainability projects. But behind the big announcement is a critical question. How will South Africa service these green loans and at what long-term cost? Some critics are warning of piling up debt for projects that could take years to yield returns. Well, let's discuss the important economics behind the deal. I'm joined by Professor Christopher Malekane from Wits University. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, just the scope of this maybe as a starting point. How significant is this package for our green plans going forward?
It's quite significant because it covers four areas. The first one being financing projects for just energy transition. And the second component is basically the just aspect of it, to upgrade skills, to create new jobs that are tied to the transition. And the fourth one is about connectivity. helping South Africa to build infrastructure, network infrastructure like rail, roads, and the digital infrastructure, expanding broadband. And the fourth one is pharmaceutical infrastructure. And there's an aspect to it as well, which they say is about creating an environment, a policy environment within which all this is going to take place. So those are the four areas, where the funding is.
Professor, on paper, obviously, this looks very good, but can South Africa realistically service this level of green borrowing, do you think?
It's a challenge because, in my own assessment, I think that South Africa is not in a position where it can absorb a lot of these foreign denominated loans, because we need first to sort out our own internal affairs. Institutionally, there are some weaknesses in terms of state capacity, even regulations and the role of the state in the economy and all of that. Like we've seen with the state-owned enterprises, their performance and so forth. All of that can impact on the ability of the country to service these loans. Because a critical point that you've made, Jeremy, is that if a country absorbs foreign denominated loans, it needs to quickly have exporting activity to earn foreign exchange to pay back these loans. But as matters stand, I don't think South Africa, at the rate at which we're absorbing these loans, we're going to be able to service them.
But it's a difficult one, though, isn't it? Because we have very little choice but to proceed with a green agenda going forward.
Yeah, but, we've got autonomy as well. The rate at which we proceed must be determined by our capacity to pay back the costs associated with the transition. For me, I think the starting point for South Africa to have a very clear industrial policy and industrial strategy, and on that basis, then absorb loans where we need to and channel them in areas that will assist us to boost our capabilities to export. But as matters stand, I'm not sure, it's not clear what our industrial strategy is, what our targeted sectors are that are going to earn us, the foreign exchange.
And if we don't have that strategy and have it quickly, we simply are risking debt for infrastructure that's not going to pay off fast enough.
Exactly. So, for example, one of the things that the investment says it wants to assist South Africa with is the ability of South Africa to produce green hydrogen, and make South Africa to be leading. But in my own assessment, I think that South Africa can gain more by adding value to its existing minerals. For example, manganese, chromium, the PGMs, and even iron ore. I mean, there's a study that I did some time back which showed that 80% of diesel engines that were running in the EU were using PGMs that were based on the PGMs that were produced in South Africa, basically, the autocatalytic converters, So we can, build industries based on our minerals. And then on that basis, then be able to finance whatever transition, low carbon at the pace that we can afford as a country.
And Professor, what's the broad macro risk here if projects underperform and the debt repayments mount?
So the major risk is that then the country becomes extremely vulnerable to exchange rate movements. If the exchange rate then depreciates, then it means that our ability to pay back the debt gets impacted. And then from a macroeconomic point of view, then we'll have a bias towards increasing interest rates every time the exchange rate depreciates, because we are afraid now that our debt is going to balloon, the capital base of our debt is going to balloon in rand terms. So it just distorts the macroeconomic policy management of the country if we've got high foreign denominated debt.
And of course, Professor, in life there is no such a thing as a free lunch. Is the European Union using green funding, do you think, to advance its own industrial interests here?
Yes, of course. So the European Union has had this initiative called the Raw Materials Initiatives, which started in 2008 as a response to the entry of China on the African continent. So they were threatened by the fact that China could basically redirect the supply of critical mineral resources for the EU. So they went on a charm offensive. I'm sure you remember we had foreign ministers visiting Africa, There was a wave of visits from these foreign ministers. It was a drive for each country to try and secure the supply for raw minerals from Africa. So if you look at the funding, the first pillar of the just energy transition is called critical raw minerals. And the Europe's critical raw mineral, the most critical for Europe, is manganese, chrome, PGMs, iron ore, you know. And South Africa, we know, produces more than 80% of each of those. So, yeah, so they are in that offensive to try and secure their minerals, and in that investment booklet.
So just a quick one in conclusion. If you were advising Treasury then, what would the one safeguard be that you would insist on?
The first is that we need to safeguard our independence as a country to pursue a low carbon path at our own pace. Two, we need to secure more funding to help South Africa to build on its strengths, to build South African capabilities, South African-owned capabilities, and to add more value to our minerals, particularly the critical minerals. And for Treasury, to also look at ways in which South Africa is the largest producer of some of the critical minerals, for South Africa to begin to set the price, like OPEC is doing with oil. We can do that with all the minerals that we have, where we produce more than 80%. And we can partner with other countries to extract as much value as possible. And we can self-fund if that is the case.
Professor yeah. Christopher Malikani, thank you very much indeed, from the School of Economics and Finance at the University of the Witwatersrand here in Johannesburg.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
More than 13 million South Africans are rejected for credit every quarter, locking many people out of the formal economy and pushing them into illegal lending networks that can charge up to 600% interest each year. The microfinance sector argues that outdated credit fee caps are worsening the exclusion, and that a targeted review could unlock billions in growth and support township economies. So let's discuss the urgency of reform and what's broadly at stake. And I'm joined now by Leonie van Pletsen, who's Chief Executive Officer of Microfinance South Africa. Leonie, why then are so many South Africans being rejected for credit? What's behind this?
So the main reason is that our credit pricing framework is outdated. The rates and fees of our industry haven't been reviewed since 2015, while compliance and operating costs have actually increased quite substantially. So this has squeezed the former lenders, especially the smaller and developmental ones, and forcing them to reduce their risk appetite and decline more clients just to stay sustainable. So as a result, 72% of credit applications are now rejected, and we are pushing millions of consumers into the illegal market where they pay more than 600% interest.
Why has there been no review then for over a decade?
So I think it is a problem that we had with government. However, I can say that there has been some traction with regards to that. So this is a top priority for the association, and we are working with the National Credit Regulator and also with the DTIC to see that we can review the rates. So we've completed a data-driven review with independent research, and this has been submitted to the National Credit Regulator and to the DTIC.
Ideally, then, what would a different rates model look like?
Well, the best rate model would be an inflational increase. So, taking back from 10 years up until where we are now, inflationary increase would be great, not even taking the additional cost of compliance into consideration. And then going forward, maintaining that inflational increase to say every year, you know, the pricing of these short-term unsecured or unsecured credit providers goes up with 1% or 2% to make sure that their businesses are sustainable. Because just to give you some insights, you know, with the FIC compliance, taking that into consideration, we are in a capped environment, but we have to do all of these additional screenings, we have to do all of these additional checks, and we have to take it from the current rate that we had that hasn't been updated in 10 years.
Do you have a sense as to how big the illegal credit market is right now then as a result of where we find ourselves?
So this is a huge market. I think we really want to do more studies on this. But, you know, Wonga has done a previous study, the Mashonisa study. And just in a certain area, there was more than 50,000 illegal credit providers. And we can really see that they are growing. And if we are looking at the statistics of the National Credit Regulator's data, we can see the rejection rates are 72%. So where are those guys going? Because the need for credit is still there. They are accessing credit, just not in the formal market.
How much credit then could be unlocked through regulatory reform?
So we feel that a balanced review could unlock 350 billion rand into the economic stimulation. So a fair and sustainable credit framework could unlock a lot of money and could drive the economic activity. That money will flow directly into townships, to small businesses and households, funding education, housing, and also entrepreneurs.
So the important thing then is to also balance wider access with strong affordability checks, and that then would create the kind of equilibrium that you want.
Definitely. Affordability regulations remain key. Consumers should not have access to credit if they can't afford it. So there will still be rejection rates. And we do not want the rejection rates to be zero. We simply want the rejection rates to be the 55% what it was 10 years ago, because then we were in a sustainable, you know, economic growth and businesses. So we don't want the rejection rates to be zero. We still want there to be, you know, affordability regulations and fair access to credit. But currently, the sustainability of the sector is under a lot of pressure, and the loan sharks and the machinistas are thriving.
What happens then if nothing changes in the next year or so?
I can tell you, formal credit will become, you know, there won't be a lot of formal credit anymore. The loan sharks will actually just increase. Consumers will struggle more, because in the informal market, they pay 600% per annum for credit. So the regulated market will just, you know, decrease their appetite for risk. They will exit the market, and we will leave the consumers actually in a more dire situation.
Are we seeing that microfinance sector already starting to do that?
Yes, definitely. If we look at our rejection rates, it keeps on increasing. Because our fees has not been increased, we don't have any appetite for risk. The bigger problem we also have is with thin file clients. So that is, you know, consumers coming out of matric. They want access to credit to start a small business or to buy something in order to, you know, go to work. And we don't actually offer them any credit anymore. So immediately those guys go out of matric and they fall into that spiral of the illegal market.
I'm going to leave it there. Leonie van Pletsen, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of Microfinance South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to this. And South Africa is sitting with one of the highest youth unemployment rates in the world. Formal jobs are shrinking, industries are shifting, and traditional degrees are no longer enough. Now there's a bold new push underway to make universities the so-called next engines of job creation. And at the heart of it is the Entrepreneurship Development in Higher Education program, and it's led by University South Africa. And as I understand it, it has an aim to turn campuses into real launch pads for innovation and enterprise. All well and good, but how's it going to work? Well, with me now is Dr. Edwill Gumbo, who is Director of Entrepreneurship at the institution. Dr. Gumbo, a very warm welcome to you. Universities have long produced job seekers, but not job creators. What must fundamentally change to reverse that, in your opinion?
Yes, good day and good day to the listeners. Thank you so much for that question. I think, firstly, we have to go to the traditional structure of a university. Universities being set up as centers that produce knowledge through the teaching, learning, and research. So, and this knowledge that is generated by universities also includes the production of graduates that are aligned with the needs of the economy. And what we've seen in the recent past is that the very same products of the universities who are graduates are struggling to find employment because the job market has shrunk over the last couple of years. Big industries have been shrinking, have been sharing jobs. And with that in mind, then, research has actually pointed us that universities then need to kind of change the model to produce graduates that are entrepreneurial, that think entrepreneurial, that while they can still join the workforce as employees, but some and those who can should be able to create their own jobs as entrepreneurs. And as a preamble to that, then we need to create an ecosystem, which is the university ecosystem that enables that.
Well, let's talk about that ecosystem. You talk about changing the model, but Dr. Gumba, I'd suggest to you that you've got a long way to go on this, because it's going to be difficult, surely, to embed entrepreneurship into the DNA of institutions. that are still built on old traditional academic models.
Yes, no, definitely. But again, you're able to use those structures, that have university structures that have existed some for centuries, to actually just change them, tweak them a bit, to introduce certain competencies that all the students at universities, you know, are exposed to, that will then lead to the production of this, of the entrepreneurial graduates. Difficult as is, but we have seen one thing about academia, by the way, is that because it's all about producing knowledge, the people who produce knowledge are aware of the current challenges, and any valuable knowledge should be able to transform society. And if the current model is producing graduates that are not transforming society, as they sit at home with no economic participation, hence the easy adoption of this model through the different frameworks on how one can embed entrepreneurship into the curricula.
Many universities, and I think you'll agree with me, talk about innovation but often struggle with delivery. What then will the entrepreneurship development in a higher education program do differently on the ground?
Yes, so this program then seeks to create, you know, the whole ecosystem of entrepreneurship development. If you look at within the university ecosystem, you've got the technology transfer offices that seek to, you know, drive even the registration of patents, you know, the management, as well as the commercialization. Entrepreneurship development in higher education coordinates all those initiatives to say which of the knowledge, which of the research can be commercialized. What is needed? Some of our universities already have incubation hub. They have different names. Some are calling them the centers of entrepreneurship rapid incubators, the CIFERIs. Some have got the, they call them the innovation hubs. Some call them even, they have maker spaces. These are different structures within the university that then drive the innovation. And when it comes to innovation, you know, against popular belief, where some people think that innovation is like your deep tech, you know, or creating something absolutely new. Yes, there is that part, but there's also relooking current models of business, current products, current services to say, how can they be remodeled to actually reach the market in a much better way?
I acknowledge the bold thinking, but how do you address resistance from academics who might see entrepreneurship as outside their mandate?
Yes, it's true. I don't think it's really like your hardcore resistance. It's all about, so imagine you have an academic who is an expert in his field for quite a number of decades, two or three decades, and then you are then giving them this framework that they need to start introducing entrepreneurial competencies and attributes into what they are teaching and into what they are lecturing towards, leading towards the production of certain graduates. So it's not really about resistance, but it's about, you know, bringing them on board and acknowledging that this may be something new to them. But they are pretty much aware intend to do. They are pretty much aware in terms of what is needed. And to help them, while the entrepreneurship development in higher education is not only focused on students only, but we also focus on staff capacity development, where we run workshops, we run programs, we help the creation and the development of frameworks that they will then help to the academics to actually unpack and support the production of entrepreneurial graduates.
All very well and good to have the ideas, and again, I salute you, but critical that students get practical support to move from ideas to actual business and business that has scale.
Definitely. So that's why initially I mentioned it as an ecosystem. So the university entrepreneurial ecosystem is not only limited to the boundaries of what is inside a university. The whole ecosystem, you're talking about the university, the quadruple helix, the university, civil society, the government and the private sector, where the university students and graduates then have access to your private incubators, have access to your corporates, where they open up their doors to provide certain models, including funding. This then ecosystem, you know, provides even the practical, you know, aspects. And some of these, we talk about civil society as well. You're looking at even bringing on board some of the entrepreneurs that have walked the path. They have done it all, not really done it all, but they have done it. You know, they have practiced where they're able to share their journeys with the students. And even if I may as well, the program doesn't only look at just student to say you start your business while still a student. It's a skill that one has to have. It's an attribute that one has to have that you can decide to start applying it while still a student. You can decide to actually graduate and look for a job. But that attribute and skill, you have it with you. The day you decide to start a business, you know what to do. You're not starting from zero.
And Dr. Gumba, are you setting targets, maybe jobs created, ventures launched, funding unlocked? How are you going to measure the success or failure of this initiative?
Thank you so much. You know, when it comes to metrics of measurement, this is where I tend to disagree with some of the programs where you tend to set job creation as a target. For example, I'll pick on one. It's all good and square, but one has to understand the whole value chain of entrepreneurship development, that when somebody is having a startup, firstly, in terms of creating jobs, you know, it's a cost, it's a process, it takes a while for the startups to be ready to actually create jobs. And job creation is a consequence of the growth of the company. And the company can only grow when it has access to the market, and the market is growing where the products, you know, there is a great need of the products. So what targets do we set for the entrepreneurship in higher education? Our targets is how many students are involved and participating in these programs where they get a skill. That's number one. And then number two, we have set up what we call at our universities the economic activation offices. That's an office that coordinates anything to do with entrepreneurship development, housing it within the office of the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research and Innovation, that coordinates all entrepreneurship development. And the reason why we created that office, to avoid duplication, where you have a certain faculty of science doing something, faculty of commerce doing something, and then they don't talk to each other. And then you've got the technology transfer office as well doing something, where you end up duplication programs. Right. So the EAO, we've set it as a target to say, it must be established at each and every university and coordinating all the entrepreneurship development programs at a university, and also promoting transdisciplinary, where the science students, those that are studying science, engineering, commerce, humanities, are able to put together in the co-creation of problems, to co-creation of solutions to some of the problems that we face.
Well, it's bold, it's big, it's ambitious, and I wish you all the very best of luck. That is Dr. Edwell Gumbo, Director of Entrepreneurship at the Entrepreneurship Development in Higher Education Program. As I said at the beginning of our conversation, it's led by Universities South Africa. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.